Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, welcome to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking with Mari Sperber and asking about whether sports are destroying American universities. I'd like to wish everyone a happy Valentine's Day and also take note that with this episode, we begin our 9th year on the air. So thank all of you for your support and for once again the honor of being with you. Philosophers have long debated the purpose of sport. Is it a celebration of human excellence or war in another form? Are competitive games shared experiences that help maintain stable societies, or simply panaceas intended to distract people while their leaders exploit them? If you add education into the mix, the conflict only gets worse. Should student athletes get special treatment? Is money for sports better used in the classroom? Why is bad behavior so frequently excused, whether on the part of athletes, parents, or fans? All of these debates have philosophical roots. They exploit the tension between individual benefit and collective good, and they blur the lines between the public and the private. When people disagree about the fairness of tax-funded stadiums, they're asking about the political role of sports. And when they argue about whether kids should play team sports, they're questioning the nature of education. Today's show is going to focus on the relationship between sports and undergraduates, but it will dip into all of these topics in the process. With this in mind, I'd like to make a few comments, in part because when people talk about sport, they often take certain ideas for granted. First, we have to acknowledge the difference between sports and athletics. Athletics are physical activities that people do for exercise or entertainment. They're often organized by the players themselves and aim at personal health, well-being, and social unity. They share a kind of interpersonal intimacy and can include friendly pickup games on the basketball court, but also a solitary jog or meditative swim. Of course, they can be dangerous or hyper-competitive, but for the most part, athletics add nuance and balance to people's lives. Sports, in contrast, are organized competitive events that are aimed at spectators as much as participants. The people who manage them are different than the people who play them. They're specialized activities and glorify competition. They are often focused on extrinsic and not intrinsic good. Let me explain the last part. An intrinsic good is a benefit that is inseparable from an activity. Jogging intrinsically improves stamina, and baseball intrinsically improves hand-eye coordination. An extrinsic good is a benefit that doesn't really have anything to do with the game. So a jogger may get a date because he or she looks good running, or a baseball player may get rich. But most people never see these benefits, and you could take them away without affecting the activity. Sports focuses on extrinsic goods because the athletes are not just interested in the skills, they want fame, money, scholarship, and college admission. This is not to say that sports don't have intrinsic goods as well, but all professional and Division I and II college sports prioritize the things that simply don't have anything to do with the game. Our conversation today will be about this, not about the athletics that are necessary for all of us to be physically and mentally healthy people. We should also be attentive to what I call the sports we. The phenomenon of fans celebrating a team victory or loss by shouting, "We won," or "We lost." This is more than just brand loyalty. It is identifying with someone else's achievements. It permeates all sports, from championship riots to the national celebration of 1980's Olympic miracle on ice. Now, athletes say fan response is important to teams, and as someone who has spent a lot of time on stage, I get this. But inspiring someone is not the same as accomplishing something. To me, at least, it feels like the sports we is just another way of getting people to buy more sweatshirts and enabling them to sit on the couch eating nachos while taking credit for other people's hard work. My final comment to prepare our discussion is not about sports at all, but about the college experience. Given the nature of our guest's work, we're going to be critical of sports in higher education. It may sound at times as if we long for a so-called great university of the past, a time when students learned for learning's sake and colleges were pure in their academic missions. This would be misleading. That time never existed. Universities have always been complex. Students have always been easily distracted, and teachers have always had diverse talents. Historically, college life has been exclusive and elite. In contrast, the American system of higher education is teaching more students from more backgrounds than ever before. They're more responsive to the economically disadvantaged, the ethnically diverse, and those with different abilities. These are wonderful achievements, and they should be celebrated. The question before us is what sports has to do with them and whether they hinder or help schools evolve. What we will see is that sports has changed both the college experience and the purpose of education itself. Whether this is good or bad will be for you to decide. And now our guest. Murray Sperber is a visiting professor in the Cultural Studies of Sport and Education program at the University of California, Berkeley. He taught for many years at Indiana University, Bloomington, and is now a professor emeritus of English and American Studies. He's written 7 books, including Beer and Circus, How Big Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education. Murray, thanks so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you for inviting me, Jack.
We're live this evening, so we'd love to have your questions and comments. You can email us at askwhy@und.edu, tweet us at Why Radio Show, or join the conversation with our intern, Darren, at our chat room at whyradioshow.org. So, Murray, with a topic as divisive as the relationship between sports and college life, how do you approach it as a scholar? Is it possible to take the venom out of the debate, or is that just an intrinsic part of the discussion?
Well, I think as a scholar, you've got to begin with some distinctions. And of the approximately 4,000 American colleges and universities, including community colleges, playing sports, the vast majority are very different from, say, the University of Oregon or the University of Minnesota in big-time conferences, or even the University of North Dakota in a smaller conference. And the vast majority are much more student-based, much more what are called club sports, do not have high-powered, high-paid coaches involved, and are for fun and games, basically, and are very positive. Now, what attracts the most attention are the big-time conferences and the lesser ones who give athletic scholarships. The vast majority of schools don't. But once you're involved with athletic scholarships, you're involved with professional coaches and staffs, athletic department staffs, and that creates the most attention. It certainly, those are the teams that are on TV and create national attention, generate huge amounts of money, and, as the NCAA itself points out, lose huge amounts of money. And so that's where the problems in college sports lay, not in the club sports, the athletics in sports.
Are the new sports as potentially divisive as the big ones like baseball and basketball and football? And I ask that because I know of a small college in North Carolina that now gives scholarships for mountain biking, and another one gives scholarships for rock climbing. And these certainly don't have the power or the attention that the March Madness has, for example. Is this drive to bigness an inevitable part of college sports once you start giving scholarships, or is it really just the ones that hold the centerpiece in the American imagination?
Well, I remember when I began research on sports years ago, I came across a quote from a famous American historian who said, "Americans lack a psychology for losing. Winning is all important to Americans." And so even those mountain bikers in North Carolina, I'm sure, want to win. I don't even know how you win in mountain biking, probably time or something like that, course, staying on the course, kind of like skiing, I suppose. But they probably want to win. And once you want to win, there are people who will do almost anything. They'll certainly hire coaches who will drive the athletes, drive those mountain bikers down those hills at greater speeds and greater risks. And So it's really interesting that American – well, the whole athletic scholarship is very American. And by the way, I'm not an American. I'm a Canadian citizen, although I've lived in this country 50 years. So I certainly know America.
Is it different? Is it different in Canada? Because I know where we are, hockey in southern Canada, hockey is the be-all and end-all, and all these families send their kids off to boarding schools.
Although it's different in the sense that university hockey is much less important. And if you're high school age and an outstanding hockey player, including in North Dakota, by the way, and you have dreams and your family have dreams of playing in the National Hockey League, you go into junior hockey. You're given some schooling, but essentially you're entering minor league hockey. Increasingly, university hockey. When I did research 25 years ago for my book, College Sports, Inc., I was curious as to how many players in the National Hockey League had played Canadian university hockey. And I called up their office in New York at that time, and they said, we'll get back to you. And they found one player, a guy named Mike Ridley, who had played at the University of Calgary, and he hadn't gone into junior hockey because he had been very small at the time. He later had a growth spurt and had a very good NHL career. But Canadian schools, by and large, don't give hockey scholarships. Now, they're starting to imitate American schools, and there's a whole movement in Canada. You know, isn't it terrible that American schools are stealing our best players and that sort of thing? But traditionally in Canada, and certainly in Europe, and in Latin America, there's no such thing as an athletic scholarship given by a university. And if you're a great soccer player as a kid, you go into a club system. You don't certainly go to university to play professional soccer.
We know quite well one of the women on the hockey team here, and she is a German national, and she went home during the Olympics to play on the German national team, yet she is a member of the UND team. I want to ask, you're
– Right, and she couldn't get an athletic scholarship in Germany.
That's right. That's right. Right. And so this really is a new idea, and we are the centerpiece of this in the United States. And I want to ask – You do cultural studies, but you're an English professor first. What does an English professor bring to the study, and what drove you to move away from the more traditional understanding of English as literature or even just English as cultural studies to this specific question?
Well, I don't know if you followed the whole profession of English in universities, but it – starting in the 1970s, became more and more theoretical and more hermetic, it seemed to me, and was going down a kind of one-way street, as the French say, a closed street. And that didn't hold a lot of interest to me, and I had a sabbatical and by chance got a job as a sports reporter, which fulfilled a childhood dream. But when I went back to Indiana, I wanted to go into American studies and study sports full time because I had a sense that it was becoming more important. When I was an undergraduate at Purdue University in the early 1960s, sports were important. It was Big Ten sports. We played the University of Minnesota and everything, but we only played them on weekends. And I had a roommate who was a wrestler. And he wasn't making his grades one semester, and his coach left him off road trips as a kind of punishment so that he could get his grades up. I mean, it was a different era where sports were much more on the periphery of the culture. But in the 1980s with ESPN, I remember I had this kind of moment. I was in Florida. I was in Jacksonville, and I turned on the TV, and there it was a Tuesday night, and there was a hockey game between the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Boston Bruins. And when I was growing up in Canada, you only saw hockey on Saturday night. That's why Canadian, the CBC to this day, it's hockey night in Canada, it's Saturday night. But of course, it's all nights of the week now. And I just had the sense that sports was becoming more and more central to the culture, and things like ESPN were going to become very dominant in the culture. And because I love sports and have been fascinated by it, I switched fields in a sense and went into the full-time study of sports.
You spent a fair amount of time in the book talking about this period, talking about the 1980s and ESPN and this shift in the student culture. And I, of course, I was an undergraduate in the late 80s. And my wife and I often talk about how no one would wear their team sweatshirts to class, that no one would right. – that this perpetual scenery of, for us, the UND mascot everywhere – this didn't exist. And I thought it was my imagination, but you actually say that – college sports changed the culture so much, and ESPN changed the culture so much that even the way students dressed changed. What's going on in the 1980s, and how does the culture shift to become such a dominant sports-filled educational experience?
Well, I think two things come together. I mean, the title of my book, Beer and Circus, are the two things. There always has been a party scene in university life, but it had been confined mainly to the weekends. In the 1980s, with cable TV, ESPN being the largest, but all kinds of regional cable as well, they needed something to feed it. I remember in the early days of ESPN, they were showing Australian rules football just to keep the monster fed. And but increasingly, there was a Supreme Court decision in 1984 which broke the NCAA's stranglehold on the broadcasting of college football. And this allowed colleges to sell football games to whoever wanted to broadcast them, and ESPN did, and also wanted various nights of the week. The other thing that ESPN pioneered was March Madness, the NCAA men's basketball tournament and subsequently the women's tournament. And that had never been a big thing. I remember when Purdue was in the 1969 finals against UCLA, it was shown in the middle of a Saturday afternoon, and it was not a big thing. But what ESPN did is they broadcast every game, and CBS broadcast the finals and such. And this created a whole month of college sports, and football became many nights during the week. Students, of course, went to the games and have long partied.
But you actually said in the book that the other great turning point was the movie Animal House, that too changed not only what people expected of college, but the self-images of college, that even the University of Oregon, which is where it was filmed, began to mimic the movie so that they could be more like the fake 1950s that the movie depicts.
Exactly. That movie was made in the late 1970s. And the 1960s, in terms of fraternities, was their worst decade. Many went broke, closed, and such. And coming into the 1970s, fraternities, I know a number of campuses. I remember Indiana, the faculty voted to outlaw them, and it was one vote that saved them. But that movie had tremendous influence. Another thing that had tremendous influence were the beer companies. Miller introduced Miller Lite and had these ads directed at college students. There was this cute dog called Spuds McKenzie, and in ads directed at college students. MTV started, and started their whole spring break. Spring break had long existed, but it had not been a huge ritual involving millions of students as it became. So all these elements came together, in a sense, to redefine university life and student life. And also, unfortunately, universities were changing. They were becoming, certainly public universities, but many private ones, were becoming much more research-oriented. And that costs huge amounts of money. And it involves faculty doing large amounts of research. And whereas teaching is very labor-intensive, and that was handed over to graduate students or part-timers. And so undergraduate education became increasingly neglected, and schools consciously and unconsciously started using the whole party scene, which revolves around athletics, as a kind of substitute for a real education. And it was a kind of perfect storm of many things going wrong in the university at that time.
What strikes me about your work, and what was perhaps the biggest surprise to me, was when I started reading it, I expected, and it came on in the book, about to read about corruption and scandal and the amount of money. We're going to talk about that after the break. But what was so striking was how, in order to talk about sports, you have to talk about the student culture. You have to talk about what it means to be a student. We only have about 2 minutes before we have to take a break, but can you talk about these big schools, Madison, Wisconsin, University of Oregon, Ann Arbor, Michigan? Can you talk about these schools without talking about sports, or is being a student so inherently intertwined that drinking, partying, skipping class, what you do on a Saturday night, how you dress, is it just you can't separate sports from the equation?
Well, it depends on the school. I'll give you a good example. Both my alma mater and where I am now, the University of California at Berkeley, it's when people talk about the sports element and the student element and a certain amount of partying, they talk about Cal, and the athletic department sells equipment that says Cal. However, when faculty talk about the university and 32 Nobel Prize winners and various other things, and alumni talk about it, they talk about Berkeley. In fact, I remember a number of years ago, somebody asked me, are there two separate schools there, Cal and Berkeley? And so often when faculty talk about Michigan, they talk about Ann Arbor.
Right.
And when alumni, I went to a doctor the other day, actually, and he was very proud of his degrees at Michigan and such. But he talked about Big Blue, which is what students and people who love the University of Michigan athletics call it. And so there's this interesting separation. University of North Carolina, academics call it Chapel Hill. Fans call it UNC.
Right.
And but now both sides are very embarrassed by the recent scandals. But so it depends on the school. However, I've never heard, for instance, Alabama talked about other than the whole mix of Alabama and many other schools like that that are so known for sports that you're absolutely right. It's totally interchangeable. And in a sense, you know, I almost defy you to tell me something about the University of Alabama that is not involved in sports.
Well, I happen to know somebody who is an Adam Smith scholar who was in Alabama and then left. But that you know, that's just gossip. When we get back, we're going to dive right into this question of the impact of sports on academics. You're listening to Murray Sperber and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with the author of Beer and Circus, Murray Sperber, about college sports and its impact on the cultural life and the academics at universities. You know, there's an urban legend. I first heard it from my wife. I've already mentioned the show. But when she told it, she told the way that everyone always tells urban legends, that it happened to someone who someone knew. But it's the story goes as follows. A professor in some department, like an English department, gets a phone call. And it's the head coach. And the head coach says, you know, our starting quarterback is ready for the big game, and he has to play in order to keep his eligibility, and the scouts are in the stand, and this is the most important game of the season, and we really need him to play, but he's failing your class. Could you see it in your heart to just pass him and get him past this hump so that he can play the big game? And the teacher says, okay, you know, I can do that, but you need to do something for me. And the coach says, sure, absolutely, anything you want. And the English professor says, well, I have this guy. He's an incredible literature scholar. He's going to be the best Shakespearean who ever lived. But his dream is to start in a big game. He has no skills whatsoever. But do you think that you could start him this Sunday and give him the dream? The coach, of course, hung up, and the professor never heard from him again. Now, I have no idea if there's any truth to that story, if it ever happened at any point. It sounds like the perfect story for an urban legend. But it reveals, of course, this tension between not only who gets priority, but what's important in life and who can cut a break. And of course, you can compromise on a grade in class, but you can't compromise on the big game. And so, Murray, I guess I want to ask you, is the conflict between sports and academics, is it unavoidable in a big institution where so much energy, so much fame, so much focus is on sports, or is it possible to be a athlete scholar? Is it possible to respect both spheres for what they both do well?
Well, let me talk about the urban legend for a second. I think one of the sources, I should really check it out, James Thurber, the American humorist, went to Ohio State, or they now call it the Ohio State University, in the 1910s. And he later wrote very humorous stories about it. And one of them featured a very thick and intellectually challenged football player. And there were, I think the situation that the urban legend is based on one of his stories. But it also answers the second part of your question, in that we're talking, James Thurber, I think, graduated from Ohio State in like 1916 or something. And so we're talking long, long ago, and 100 years, and might have been a few years after that. But this conflict has been going on since they blew up the first pigskin in the late 19th century and started playing. And the main conflict, what causes the conflict, is that obsession with winning. And in the early days of football, and this was very true where you are, there were what were called tramp athletes. Schools would hire players for the season. And they would come and they would play under various assumed names, and they would move on to other schools. And and would play some professional football on the weekend, pro football being very roused about at that point. So there's been cheating and there's been conflict with the academic priorities of the universities from the beginning. And it has not been easily solved. As far as scholar athletes go, I know
I just want to add that this, by the way, to emphasize how all this is the plot of the Marx Brothers' Horse Feathers.
Oh, of course.
That Groucho Marx hires these fake athletes to and then of course Chico and Arpo get involved, so it becomes a farce. But it's the plot of this I guess 70-year-old movie now.
Right. Right. And
so scholar athletes, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah.
No. I know I'm often asked about Bill Bradley, who was a scholar athlete, a U.S. senator, was an outstanding player at Princeton. A guy named Tom McMillan, who they were both Rhodes Scholars. Pete Dawkins, a football Rhodes Scholar and such. I went to Purdue with a basketball player who became a Rhodes Scholar named Robert Orrell. I guess in any bell curve, there are people out at the end who can do remarkable things in different fields. But as far as people in the middle, where almost every athlete exists, as well as regular students, it's very difficult to be a real scholar athlete because, in a sense, you're doing two full-time jobs. To play college sports, you are in a physical program of practice, of film watching, and then participation, at least 40, 50, sometimes 60 hours a week. To get a meaningful education at any school that I know of, you've got to put in at least 40 hours a week, if not more. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to do it. Now, my hat's off to those who can and those who try. Very often, athletes have to really work on their studies after their eligibility is over. You have 4 years eligibility with the NCAA. In the program that I teach in, it's in the Graduate School of Education at Berkeley, and we give a master's degree in cultural study of sports and education. And quite a number of our students over the years, I've been there since 2008, have been former collegiate and even some played pro sports. And now they're the first to admit that when they were in school, now the women can do better than the men in that they don't have any illusions about playing professional sports. A couple are good enough to play Olympic sports, but most realize this is their chance of a free athletic scholarship. So they're trying harder as undergraduates, but they admit that they underachieved. I mean, they were so mentally and physically exhausted much of the time that they academically underachieved. Although when they can finally focus on their work, after their eligibility is over, either as undergraduates or graduate students, they bring a wonderful discipline to studying and to learning. They're also much more coachable than our regular graduate students. I know as an English teacher, I have to help students with their writing. And very often regular students have not learned to write very well in some of the most famous universities in this country. Nobody has line edited their work. Nobody has really told them that they have specific problems and helped them with it. And I find I have to do that in graduate school. And the regular students are often resistant. And they'll say, well, you know, I won this award at Michigan. I won X, Y, and Z at Minnesota. But the athletes, if they buy into what you're teaching, are very teachable, I think. And that comes from their sports training. And so it's been an education for me to teach people who were student athletes. Now, they're no longer student athletes. They're, you know, full-time in school. But they do very well. I think the dumb jock stereotype, such as what James Serber played off of, tends to be a stereotype. I've met very, very few athletes over the years who did not have the mental ability to make it through university, but they often didn't simply because of the time demands.
You know, the critical thinking theorist Richard Paul argued that the best critical thinking on campus is done on the sports teams after the game, when the coach sits down with the team and looks at the films and says, you did this well, you did that poorly, here's how to change the game, reflect on your own game. But I want to shift the conversation because we've got some questions, particularly right. from Maya in Grand Forks, who wants to know about the role of money in sports and in scholarships. She actually asked this question, if athletes should be paid, should high achieving students be paid. But before we even get to that level of detail, you said something in the first half of the show that will surprise a lot of people, which is sports programs very rarely make money. In fact, they siphon tremendous amounts of money off of the university and off of academics. So the NCAA is a nonprofit organization, yet they have this incredible amount of money. What's going on? What's happening with the finances? Are we being bilked?
Well, let me reference a very good study. The Washington Post this past fall had a series of in-depth feature articles on money in college sports, and with some excellent, excellent charts that show, among other things, how much money the University of Minnesota loses, by the way, as well as Wisconsin, and how every school in the Pac-12 conference, except for Oregon, loses money. And Oregon claims a profit because Phil Knight, the founder and essentially the owner of Nike, contributes a huge amount, makes up their deficit every year. I think what's going on, which I long ago studied and have been following for many years, is however much money athletic departments make, and they are making a fortune, certainly in the big time conferences these days, they spend. They spend on employees, hiring more and more employees. They spend on the latest facilities. There's a term called the athletics arms race, where schools feel that if school A in a conference gets a brand new state-of-the-art weight room and it costs $10 million, they have to get a better weight room for $11 million. So they manage, no matter how much money they make, to lose money. And since I'm sure you're aware, every June 30th, schools must close their financial books. And if you're in deficit, the deficit has to be made up. And traditionally, schools have been moving money from other parts of the university to cover that deficit. Although often during the year, students make up the deficit by paying their activities fees, which they think goes to the school newspaper, and part of it does, and things like that. But a large part goes to sustaining the athletic department. So the NCAA itself does auditing studies, and they admit that the vast majority of schools lose money. Sorry. As far as professionalizing college sports, that's been a very controversial issue for a number of years, and it's becoming more and more controversial. And I don't know if your questioner is aware, there's a number of lawsuits that are testing that. And it's very possible that the athletes will win, and they claim that they are employees of the university and should be paid a fair wage and such. And if they win, that will change everything in college sports. And now, it's going to take a while for that to happen. It depends on things like the nature of the Supreme Court, which before our eyes is changing. And so the whole professionalization of college sports is an open question, but a fascinating one.
You know, when people sell the athletic department. They talk about alumni. They talk about donations. They talk about making money. When it turns out that you're not making any money, the question that one has to ask is, why are there sports like this? Why is this so focused? You talked a little about the human need to win and the competitive spirit, but there's this whole other discussion that you have, which as a professor I found unbelievably interesting and shocking, which was that colleges that claim to be selective aren't really selective at all, and that nothing really recommends one college over another. And the implication, you didn't say this explicitly, but I want to ask you, the implication was that in the end, the main difference between one school and another is, frankly, the sports teams and whether they win or not, because most institutions are not selective at all. Could you talk a little bit about that and how this myth of selectivity relates to the need to have winning teams?
Yeah, that's
I mean, it's a huge mouthful. I know it's a
right,
lot.
Right. The selectivity does depend on the demographics of the particular time. When I wrote the book, there were far more places in American universities than students applying. Since then, there has been a little bit of a blip, but it hasn't changed radically. I mean, the irony is the top tier of universities, about 30, are highly selective, are more selective than ever before with this common application and students applying to more schools than ever before. But after you get past the top 30, it's surprisingly unselective that many schools, for instance, just taking the Pac-12, Washington State, Oregon State, Colorado, Arizona State are not very selective at all.
And when you say they're not selective, you mean they take 80, 90%, and for some schools, pretty much everyone who applies. And in fact, the consideration of SATs is minimal, if at all, right?
Yeah, that's basically correct. I haven't looked at the U.S. News and World Report figures, although schools have now a way of kind of juggling what percentage it is, and so some of those numbers aren't correct, but you're absolutely correct. We're talking 80, 90%. One of the things that shocked me when I was doing the research was that my alma mater, Purdue, took 90%. I'd always thought it was selective. Now, I think what's happened, of course, is as these schools have raised their tuition fee, as it costs more and more to go to the schools, you're getting a smaller percentage of applicants, particularly applicants who can pay the full ride, and schools have limited scholarship potential. Now, they do try to use federal money, of course, as much as possible.
So how does this question connect to the sports question? What does this have to do with the appeal of sports?
I guess in trying to get those customers. One of the things that a lot of public schools have done, including Berkeley, is to, although their mandate is to educate the best and the brightest in their state, best and brightest high school students in their state, they're increasingly going out of state and targeting suburban areas out of state. I know Indiana University worked very hard to get suburban Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Columbus, Ohio, and such kids to come to Indiana University. And now they're paying out-of-state tuition, which, of course, is significantly higher than in-state tuition. But, of course, they're taking some positions that might go to an in-state student, particularly if Indiana could give the in-state student a scholarship. But so in a sense, to attract these students, they're often what I call the beer and circus contingent. In Indiana's case, it was students who their first choices were Michigan, Wisconsin, Notre Dame, and such, which are much are more selective schools, and they couldn't get in there. And Indiana is a great party school. And part of its whole brand is its partying and its famous basketball teams. And the football team was even pretty good last year. And so as far as selling themselves to this targeted audience who can pay the new high tuition and other costs, sports and the party scene becomes very, very important.
You know, we're almost out of time. We've got a couple more minutes. There's tons of stuff we need to talk about, which we're going to talk about in the extended podcast version. We even have a person on the phone waiting, and unfortunately we're not going to be able to get to that person, and I apologize. But I want to ask, in sort of as the last few minutes of the live episode, does this new model of attracting out-of-state students, of getting high tuition bills paid, of celebrating the sports and the party and what you call in the book the collegiate subculture, does this change the purpose of education? This is, of course, a philosophy show, so I have to ask, under this model, what is the purpose of education? And do you think, in your own opinion, is that consistent with what you think the purpose of education should be? Has college sports changed the very purpose of education, at least in the bigger state schools?
Well, I think it's all part of this new branding, the new corporate university, and regarding students not as students but as clients or customers. And part of that, of course, is building the great metaphor of the climbing walls. Many schools, to keep students entertained and for some physical activity, have built these state-of-the-art climbing walls. And so that's often in this discussion used as the metaphor. And now, as far as the purpose of education goes, I guess we all, I hope we value our own education. And I was very fortunate to get a very good education, undergraduate education at Purdue, and a superb education at the University of California, Berkeley for graduate school, which, by the way, was free and at that time. But those were humanities-based education with a lot of science at Purdue, but your essential basic science that everyone should know. And so, of course, that's the model that I like best. But I think the new student consumer, student client is much more interested in a kind of practical. The parents of that person are particularly interested in a much more practical kind of education. How will you get a good job when you graduate? And such. And of course, funneling people into business schools and others, a much more narrower technical education. And unfortunately, we live in a century now that I think the average person is going to have a minimum of 7 different jobs. So it seems to me your humanities training, a good basis in philosophy. One of the best courses I ever took was a 1-hour course at Purdue. Everyone had to take it in logic, just basic logic. And to this day, I use it. I was trying to explain to a student why argument by analogy is inherently false, because no two things are exactly the same. That is strictly from my freshman logic course at Purdue.
We do have a phone call. Jessica from New Jersey has been very patient. Jessica, welcome to Why.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
I'm doing well. You have a question for Murray or me?
I was asking, at the heart of it, why did this connection between academic study and athletics ever arise? You know, as children, the schools don't really run athletics. In my town, it's run by something called the recreation department. And across America, children's athletics are somehow done by the town or independently, or, you know, parents get together and make it happen. And then in high school and college, sports teams are attached to high schools and to colleges. It's part of the school. But then beyond college, then it becomes professional. So if sports, you know, does exist in other ways at other age levels, when and how, maybe it's a historical question, did they become connected? And you did say something about Greek philosophy, you know, that the education of the mind and the education of the body going together. So it's sort of a Western civilization presupposition that these things have to be together. But then I ask myself, why is it competitive athletics then that is the education of the body? There are many other ways, you know, why not through the arts? Why not dance? Why not, I don't know, figure skating? Why not yoga? Like, why is competitive athletics the primary way that we train the body, if we're taking this Platonic notion of training the body and training the mind?
This is a great question. So there are two parts to it, Maria, as I understand it. The first is a historical question. When did athletics and sports become associated with schools and associated with this formal part of our childhood education? And then once schools end, it becomes professional and you know, leagues.
Right.
And then the second question is actually, it's fallen out of my head, but I'm embarrassed, but it'll come
right.
Back
why
to
why competitive?
Yeah, right. Thank you very much. Why is it competitive sports and not other forms of sports that are equally as arduous, equally as muscle building, equally as strategic, but aren't necessarily pitting one school against another or one child against another? Great questions.
I think the answer historically sports and schools came about really from the students. Two ways. At many schools, the students had various societies. Some of them were literary societies, but had shooting societies, duels. Fraternities evolved in the 19th century. And students, when various sports started becoming popular, baseball was one of the first college sports, and it started becoming popular in the middle of the 19th century. Students in schools wanted to play it and organized the teams, and then football. And the students even hired the coaches for a period, in the first period of football and baseball, and but that all connects to the competitiveness. When Harvard students organized one of the first football teams, and Yale students organized the team, and Princeton, and those were the first three teams really on any kind of basis. They wanted to beat their rivals. They felt Yale was better than Harvard, or Harvard better than Yale. And so pretty soon they were hiring professional coaches to train the players. And then Yale had some losses, and they hired a professional athlete and put him up in the best hotel in New Haven. And I think I always go back to that American that quote that Americans do not have a psychology for losing. When they approach any kind of endeavor, going west, expanding the country, doing whatever Americans have done, they've got to win. They cannot conceive of losing. And it's only really recently that the idea of yoga has become popular at all. We're talking 1970s. Before the 1970s, the idea of jogging didn't exist. I can remember, I'm a longtime jogger, and I jogging in the 1970s and being pulled over by the police asking me what I was doing running along this road in shorts. And so I think that whole, you know, particularly when you think about how the West was won, the real West. Now, Canadians are much better at being second. You know, Canadians don't pretend that they're going to run the world. or that they have to win all the gold medals and such. Now, they try, and certainly in some sports like hockey, it does become important. But it's always interesting to me. I go back to Canada every summer and see my family and spend a fair amount of time there. And just the difference in psychology between Americans and Canadians. It's really...
I noticed this when I moved here and we were watching the Olympics, and you can, in North Dakota, you can get American television stations and Canadian television stations.
Right.
And so on the American television stations, they would celebrate the gold medal. And if an American got a silver or a bronze, it wasn't mentioned at all. But on the Canadian station, right, they would celebrate the Canadian. This is, you know, they came in 75th, but it's the best they ever did. And so there's different kind of nationalism. And that actually makes me want to ask a follow-up question about, again, a philosophical question about the nature of competition. How much is your instinct that competition is a cultural trait as opposed to hardwired into us? Libertarians think that it's, you know, it's inherent in the human experience. Right. But someone like Alfie Kohn in his wonderful book, No Contest, makes the argument that, that competition is an institutional choice. And so is the historical celebration of sports an indication that we need this competition socially, or is it just the vicissitudes of history and people use sports for their own particular needs?
Well, there's certainly – I'm not an anthropologist, so I can't really – or biologist – answer the genetic question, but it's easy to see in different societies, even societies quite close to each other, like Canada and the United States, the different meaning of winning. And as you mentioned, the other thing in the Canadian Olympic coverage, they would show you events that were very interesting and very athletic events where Canadians weren't participating. They were just showing you the event.
America would never do that.
Yes, there's no way American TV would do that. Also, the Canadian TV did not have these soppy stories about the athlete and such. It was just a very different idea. But I think, you know, one of the things this presidential election of this year, particularly the Republicans, have done amazing things for Canada. Canada, you know, Canadian identity has always been quite fragile. And for a long period, people believed in Canada that the relationship with the United States was vertical, not horizontal, that the Pacific Northwest was like BC, that where you are was like the Canadian prairies, Ontario and Ohio. Now, Quebec has always been separate, but the Maritimes like New England. But I think I was in Canada recently and amazed at people's comments about the American election, which they follow very closely. And you know, just it's kind of unified Canadians in that they're very proud of their socialized one-payer program. They do like Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders in Canada would be right in the middle of politics. And it would be totally recognizable, would not be this kind of outside, politician. But it's a much more cooperative society. And so, therefore, in a cooperative society, individual winning is less important and less emphasized. And playing for the team is much more emphasized. Now, there's no question that in games like hockey, you want to win, but they are taught, you know, to play for the team, and to each player in hockey from very early ages is taught a specific role, and some are scorers, some aren't. You know, it's that simple, and so it is a different psychology, and so winning doesn't have to be as obsessive as it is in the United States, it would seem to me, and other societies prove that.
We also have a question from Kim in North Dakota. If schools encourage more students to participate in sports, clubs, et cetera, would that improve the engagement with and performance in their education? And the question makes me think of John Rady's wonderful book, Spark, about the way that exercise improves brain function. Do you think that – that forget the big-time sports for a second. If sports itself were a much more heavy part of all curriculum, would it improve education or would it compete with the academics even on the lower levels?
Well, no, I think it can be very positive. I've done some research on Division III schools, you know, non-scholarship schools that tend to be private, but not all. And athletes on teams there spend about 20 hours a week on their sport. And it helps organize them. It gives them a kind of social group. It's very good physically. And they do quite well in terms of academic achievement. Now, there are other factors in academic achievement. So I think it can be very positive. I personally had a number of very positive sports experiences. In graduate school at Berkeley, I played a lot of sports. I organized an English department baseball team, and we were in a league. We played. We were quite serious about practicing and everything. And it was a very good outlet from the heavy intellectual side of graduate school at Berkeley. And I subsequently played semi-pro basketball in France. And while I was working on a fellowship and working on my dissertation, and again, it was a kind of wonderful – it brought a balance to my life that if I had not played basketball – but had gone down to the cafe and, you know, talked to various intellectual friends, I don't think it would have been nowhere near as positive an experience.
So this is a random question, actually, but you're an English professor, and I really want to ask this, especially since you were just talking about balance in your life and the intellectual interactions. Sports writing as a genre is fueled by cliche, by dramatic statements, by this type of writing that is just so over the top but is celebrated in all of the best sports writing. And I guess the first question, which isn't connected to the discussion, is why do you think that is? Why do you think that sports writing is constructed in this fashion? But the second question is, if we didn't write about sports in this way, do you think we would have a different relationship with the huge sports teams and the huge sports heroes? And the movies like Rudy and Rocky and The Natural and these incredible over-the-top narratives. Is it how we describe sports, or does sports just bring that dramatic aspect of out in its literary manifestation?
Well, it's I'm glad you asked that question, because I feel very competent with my own training to answer it. Sports writing historically was not. Now, there are Grecian odes to athletes and such, but I guess modern sports writing begins in the 19th century. The British writer Hazlitt, William Hazlitt, wrote about boxing. But in a very what we would consider a kind of harsh, realistic way. And in the 19th century, a lot of sports writing was like that, boxing being the primary sport written about because it was the most popular sport, but horse racing too. What happened as college sports became more popular, and they were popular before professional sports, is that a school of sports writers called the Gee Whiz School developed. Grantland Rice was the most famous of them. But because schools wanted attention for their sports, wanted fans to come since that was the main income from the sports. They would often hire sports writers to write puff pieces and actually and to referee the games. And there was quite a few fixed games in college sports as a result. So a whole school of sports writing became very popular, and particularly with the New York press. Granlin Rice, of course, wrote The Four Horsemen of Notre Dame, you know, outlined against an October sky, wrote The Four Horsemen of Notre Dame, who were a backfield that averaged 155 pounds in weight and hardly fearsome. Were very good because Rockne emphasized speed and agility. This became the dominant trope in sports writing and was imitated by many, many other sports writers, and also, of course, went into the movies. And you're right to point to Rudy and Hoosiers and Rocky and all of this. Now, there was a contrary school called the Ah Nuts School, who a writer named Paul Gallico, who was a regular writer but also did sports writing, was very skeptical about these heroes and wrote about them. And there a small number of writers imitated this. This became more popular in the 1960s. But there's also the whole Ah Nuts school right now. And ESPN is very interesting in that they have the glorification, the gee whiz pieces, but they also, for many years, Bob Lee has done Outside the Lines, where they try to show, you know, much more the reality of sport and what goes wrong and how it can. Certainly, they've been very influential with the whole concussion question in football. And so I think the glorification comes out of this actual sports writers as publicists, and also to deal with sports departments, our athletic departments. They want to deal with writers who are going to be favorable to the team. They don't want to deal with people who might criticize the team, and writers know it, and the writers who write favorably, their lives are a lot easier than the ones who are critical, and professional teams are the same way and such, because I think it's very important to recognize people who are attracted to sports, both athletes, coaches, and fans, see the world almost in a Manichaean way. It's win or lose. There's no shades of gray. You know, the San Jose Sharks won last night. They lost the other night. And it's that if you're a NHL fan of the San Jose Sharks, that's the reality. You know, deal with it. If you're a Warriors fan, the NBA team, they've won overwhelmingly. You're, you know, in ecstasy, but many, many years went by when they lost. So it's either you're on the team with the team, as far as writers go, or you're against us. And I know when I was a professional sports writer, I had a lot of problems with this because coaches could not understand if I had some critical comments in my piece. They just thought I was trying to knock the team, make their job harder. So I think for all those reasons, there's been this tendency toward, you know, mythology. Now, some very good writers like John Updike in his piece about Ted Williams' retirement, you know, kind of fall into the mythology and play with it in that he was interested in Greek mythology. And but some very good writers have, you know, had critical pieces, too. Right.
I mean, Norman Mailer has that famous piece on boxing, which is extraordinary. But I'm also thinking of Frank DeForge on NPR, who just, you know, the exasperated philosopher as sports analysis.
Right.
I want to switch because I don't want to keep you forever, but I want to ask a different kind of question. We haven't talked about scandals at all. We haven't talked about abuse of power. And most recently, Carolina's been in the news because of the creating fake classes for the athletes and stuff. But I actually want to ask about Penn State, in part because a blog post I wrote at pqed.org, the Why Radio blog, was one of the most controversial I ever wrote. But is the stuff that happened with at Penn State and the child abuse scandals, is that inevitable or was that just an aberration? Is it just the stars aligned, for lack of a better metaphor, and this horrible thing happened? Or are the scandals just going to get worse and then they'll get a little better and then they'll get worse and better? Because one of the things that I suggested in that post was, having been a faculty member for quite a while, gossip at universities is endless and people know what's going on. And I find it hard to imagine that there wasn't at least common rumors about child rape at Penn State. And yet there was this protective cocoon around these figures. And so is Penn State just the worst example of escalating scandals, or was it an aberration and we probably won't see something like that again for a long time?
Yeah, I tend toward the latter, okay. But for a contextual reason, I think traditionally these charismatic, almost omnipotent coaches have existed in small towns. I mean, I had the experience of being at Indiana through all of Bob Knight's years. But Joe Paterno actually was a kind of benevolent dictator. He was very pro-academic. He endowed a chair in American Studies with his wife. Now he was a football coach and he wanted to win. But I don't know if you've ever been to Penn State, but it is one of the most isolated campuses in America. Right. And therefore the local newspapers in these towns tend to be very much hand in glove with the athletic department. And in Bloomington, Indiana, the editor, sports editor of the local paper, was Bob Knight's best friend. So never a harsh word. I used to say about the Bloomington Herald Times that it was worse than Pravda, but then Pravda went out of business. And it continued. So I think now the other side, of course, is there's been a lot of scandals over the years at the University of Minnesota. But that's because you have the St. Paul Pioneer Press and the Minneapolis Times. You had a number of papers that were at each other's throats. So they were more than happy to listen to those rumors and turn up scandal whenever it occurred. So I think Penn State, I don't imagine also in an internet world, Paterno and Knight came to power, and Woody Hayes, of course, at Ohio State, the Columbus Dispatch, the editor's sports editor was a guy named Paul Hornung, who used to go to games wearing a scarlet and gray Ohio State uniform, sit in the press boxes. Those days are over. I think the internet has changed that. ESPN and other networks have changed that. They're the ones who broke CNN broke the Bob Knight story eventually, and ESPN was very instrumental in the Paterno story. And so I can't see a coach ever becoming as powerful, as omnipotent, and as oblivious to what's going on as Paterno did. And yes, I'm sure there were rumors, but I'm sure the faculty was very intimidated. And as it turns out, various administrators apparently were informed of specific incidents and looked the other way or refused to believe it or various other things, or felt that the image that Paterno and Penn State had created transcended even the abuse of children. And I think the world has changed. Maybe I'm an optimist. Maybe I'm just some cockeyed optimist.
Well, you're a sports fan, so by definition, right? You're an optimist.
Well, but yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I waited a long time for the Warriors to come around, and they did.
And let me piggyback on the optimism and ask the last question, because if I don't ask this, my listeners will stone me. What can be done? Do you have any recommendations to curb the all-powerful college sports mega inc? Is there anything that can be done within the universities or about the universities that helps contain this and protects academia and whatever the mission of education is, whether it be vocational or right. research?
Well, I think, you know, let's take the University of North Dakota. I'm sure there are people there. You've gone to Division I football, but a lower division. I'm sure there are people there who want to go to the higher division. And I think it's important to resist.
Well, let me interrupt. This is really important because I think it'll help feed your answer. When the previous president, I guess two presidents ago, asked the stakeholders if they wanted to go to Division I with everything but the hockey team, 75% of every stakeholder body, 75% of the students, 75% of the faculty, 75% of the alumni, all said no. We want to stay where we are, and the president ignored it and went to Division I anyway. So part of, I guess, the push that I'm going to give to the question is there anything that can be done to resist it when the people who are resisting neither have the voice nor the power to resist?
Well, I remember a Chronicle of Higher Education article that said the average university and college president is in office 4.1 years.
Sounds about right.
And that has probably dropped. So whereas the faculty are there, you've been there many years.
This is my
15th alumni
year.
Are there for life. The people of North Dakota tend to stay in North Dakota. And so just hang in there and bring it back. And I know I had a student do a wonderful thesis for me on Davis. The University of California, mm-hmm. Davis, went like North Dakota. Went from Division II to Division I in football. And it has been a disaster, financial disaster.
For us too.
Right. And so I think it's important to, you know, get the statistics. The Public Records Act probably allows you to see what actually, you know, the actual money, the actual books. Have accountants read them carefully and read up on how accounting creative athletic department accounting is, how they move so many things off of the books. But and just, you know, keep the issue alive and the president moves on. And it's always possible to go back to Division II. But, you know, you could stay in Division I, although you're giving a lot of scholarships, you're losing. And travel, you're similar to Davis in the sense that you've got these enormous travel costs, and they're never going to go away.
Right.
And so I guess hang in there, you know, see the long arc, and presidents come and go. But people in NODAC stay in NODAC.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
And love it. I have some friends there, and they love it. They love it. So, and it's particular. You know, you're very fortunate in that. I'm sure people feel very proprietorial toward the university. It's not like my youngest daughter went to San Francisco State, and you know, people pass through a school like that. And the administration does want to bring back football and such. And there's no stakeholders who can really get together and protest. So the students are getting socked for a pretty good amount of money right now, and that could go up significantly. And these are students who can't really afford it. And Whereas in North Dakota, I think, you know, you have more control. I mean, it is a situation where the stakeholders can really assert themselves much more. So I'd recommend that.
This is true. And there's also – there's people – pay very close attention and are very supportive of the things that the university does. I mean, as I indicated in the beginning of the show, this is the beginning of the ninth year of a philosophy show that reaches every household in the state, and UND folks are very proud of it, even if they don't listen. And, of course, I'm tremendously appreciative of that. Well, this has been incredibly interesting and, of course, the start of a conversation that should last months. You've got Beer and Circus, you have College Sports Inc., and a whole bunch of other work that our listeners should find if they're interested. Right. We have links on our page. And of course, all of your writing is incredibly accessible, written for non-academics, and so no one should feel intimidated by the books. They're challenging, they're wonderful, they're interesting, and they're incredibly important. So Murray Sperber, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed this. And as I said, I enjoyed every philosophy course I ever took. I should have taken more.
Well, in the fall, I'm doing a seminar on Adam Smith. Come join us. We'd love to have you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein, Murray Sperber on Why Philosophical Discussion in Everyday Life. We'll be back with a few thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions in Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been talking with Murray Sperber about the role of sports in undergraduate education in the United States. You know, the classic Greeks, where philosophy began, they thought that athletics were essential to the moral health of a person, that the body and their ethical behavior were intertwined. And athletic education was an important part of growing up and being a whole person. The Romans took this idea and exploited it to control their population. And bread and circuses, the phrase that Murray bases his book on, Beer and Circus, is this idea that you can control people with sports. Which is it? Sports gives you a whole life experience, or sports loses you in the moment? I don't have an answer, but this question, what is the purpose of education, is essential to the discussion. And if we look at the big schools, if we look at the state schools, if we look at ESPN and March Madness, and we ask the question, what is the purpose of education as advertised, then all of the scholarly work, all of the academic work, all of the classroom work disappears, and education becomes the best days of our lives, the experiences, the collective cheer. And the question that I leave you with is that the right message for a democracy? Is losing yourself in the crowd, in celebrating the achievement of one person, is that what education in a democracy looks like? Or have we gone awry? You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussion of Everyday Life. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.